This is Grand Finale, co-host of the Drive Time Radio Show, and you are listening to WGXC Agra, 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
There is currently no vaccine or specific medication to treat COVID-19. Testing is limited in the United States. The only way to flatten the curve is through collective action. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend that all Americans practice social distancing to slow the spread of the disease and to keep from overloading the American medical system. This means staying at home and avoiding other people as much as possible. Information is available at cdc.gov/COVID-19.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Kurt Wayman of Theater Consultants Collaborative. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
You have tuned into the River Newsroom's Hudson Valley Coronavirus Report from Lissa Harris of The River and Roger Hannigan-Gilson of The Other Hudson Valley. Go to theotherhudsonvalley.com or therivernewsroom.com for more information and links to the stories included here. This report is a collaboration with several Hudson Valley journalists, airing on WGXC 90.7 FM at midnight, 5, 7, and 9 a.m., and online in the audio archives at WGXC.org. La Voz, a Spanish-language news magazine covering the Hudson Valley, is translating these roundups and co-publishing them on its website in Spanish at lavoz.bard.edu.
As of May 6th, New York State estimates they have 323,978 COVID-19 cases. That's 2,786 new cases. And of course, that's woefully undercounting, as there is not enough widespread testing to figure out what the real number is. A graphics-heavy editorial in the New York Times on May 6th makes a compelling visual case that America's flattening curve is a result of New York City's outbreak being on the downswing. Without New York Metro data, the pandemic nationwide is getting worse daily. This week has seen a flurry of breathless reporting in national news outlets on coronavirus strains and fears that the virus might be mutating. Should we be worried? Not yet, says The Atlantic's Ed Yong, who's been a necessary source of expertise in a national conversation dominated by reporters without any science training. On May 6th, Yong took aim at the media narrative that the novel coronavirus might be mutating into more contagious or dangerous forms, writing that most virologists aren't convinced there's more than one strain out there. Coronaviruses change much more slowly than the flu, Yong writes, and a mutation in a viral protein found recently by a team in Los Alamos might well have no impact on the virus's ability to spread or cause disease. Yong warns against the temptation to rely on stories about scary virus mutations to speculate about why some places get hit harder than others. Quote, powerful antagonists make for easy narratives. Ineptitude, bias, and randomness make for difficult ones, unquote, he writes. In the past week, Governor Andrew Cuomo has put three billionaires in charge of important state pandemic response projects. Mike Bloomberg is partnering with the state on contact tracing. Bill Gates is heading up an effort to reimagine education. And on May 6th, Cuomo named former Google CEO Eric Schmidt head of a commission on technology and the economy. Schmidt, who appeared on the governor's daily briefing to talk about how tech can help the state economy recover, has been charged with leading a 15-member task force focused on telehealth, remote work, and expanding broadband access. Broadband access was an urgent issue for rural New York before the pandemic hit, with the economy, education, and basic aspects of social life now even more dependent on internet access. Existing inequalities in the state have been weaponized. State Senator Jen Metzger wrote about the issue recently in the River Reporter, a weekly paper based in Sullivan County. The senator, who represents a rural slice of the Hudson Valley and Catskills in New York's 42nd District, has introduced two bills aimed at increasing access to broadband and holding internet service providers accountable. For a look at what life without broadband looks like up a rural road in Niagara County, see the four-day-a-week Lockport Union Sun and Journal. The paper spoke to a woman whose daughter is trying to attend community college by sitting in different places in the yard, trying to get a hotspot signal, struggling not to give up. One problem with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation taking a lead role in the state's efforts to rethink education: Bill Gates has a long track record in education reform, and it's not good. Washington Post education reporter Valerie Strauss, who in 2018 wrote a pretty damning story on the foundation's $575 million failed project to use student test scores to evaluate teachers, talked to educators enraged at the prospect of Gates getting another crack at the public education system. Here's teacher Kathleen Elliott Birdsall, a teacher in Cortland. Quote, "Andrew Cuomo does not value teachers. He did not include any K-12 educators on his panel for reentry from coronavirus closures. I find it incredible that he asked Bill Gates, a man who has disrupted education in so many ways, to develop a plan. Why not ask teachers, those of us in the front lines, for input?" Unquote. The results of a new three-day state study on who's getting hospitalized are in, and they're surprising. Most of the recent hospitalizations, about 83%, were of people who are either unemployed or retired, although it's important to note that there was no information on employment for 45% of the patients in the study. Quote, "We were thinking that maybe we were going to find a higher percentage of essential employees who were getting sick because they were going to work, that these may be nurses, doctors, transit workers. That's not the case," unquote, Cuomo said. A depressing outcome of the state study: the recently hospitalized patients who were predominantly Black and Latino, a trend that's in line with disproportionate COVID-19 mortality rates among those communities. Antibody tests are becoming more widely available. Wondering if you should get one? First, check out a feature in Quartz, which has a neat interactive tool that allows you to visualize how likely you are to get a result that means something based on the level of infection in your community. One of the biggest problems with antibody tests is false positives, and as Quartz notes, even tests that advertise high specificity rates are much less useful in communities where the infection level has been low. The simulator allows you to see what happens when you conduct antibody tests with different rates of specificity and sensitivity on a population, and the visuals make it clear that when infection rates in the community are low, a person who gets a positive antibody test is as likely to be looking at a false positive as a true one, even if the antibody test has a specificity of 95% or greater. Congressperson Antonio Delgado is holding a telephone town hall on May 7th at 4:30 p.m. Members of the public are invited to dial in at 855-905-3295 to ask questions. New York State announced on May 6th that daily deaths from COVID-19 in New York State were slightly up for the second day in a row at 232. The count announced on May 5th was 230, and the count the day before was 226. The news this week that there's a hotspot connected to a large greenhouse complex in central New York has Cuomo worried. He says outbreaks like this are not about food, they're about workers in close proximity. Quote, "It's not about poultry, it's not about meat, it's not about vegetables. It's when you run a facility with a large number of workers in a dense environment," unquote. That may be so, but there's no easy way to make a meat processing plant a less dense environment. A recent story in the Green Bay Press Gazette in Wisconsin, where meat plant outbreaks have been hitting hard, looked at the intense mix of industry logistics and business culture that has made workers in the meat processing industry especially vulnerable to COVID-19. The National Guard may be called in to help with the Democratic presidential primary, Cuomo's Secretary Melissa DeRosa said at the May 6th briefing. She told reporters that the primary election might not be called on election night because of the expected number of absentee ballots. Quote, "We want to make sure that the counting process is done right and it's thorough and that people continue to have confidence and faith in democracy," unquote, DeRosa said. Cuomo said at the May 6th briefing that states loosening restrictions on businesses and gatherings before the outbreak is on the downward slope are making a mistake. Quote, "We do not have the virus on retreat all across the state. Different levels of retreat in different parts of the state, but it is on retreat in all parts of this state, which is dramatically different than the numbers for the nation, which is worth noting. You have states that are opening where you still are in the incline. I think that's a mistake," unquote, he said. JetBlue is donating 100,000 pairs of round-trip flights for medical personnel and nurses. Here's the county-by-county roundup, first with Rockland County, where Pfizer, which has a location in Pearl River, announced May 6th that the first participants have been dosed in the U.S. in the clinical trial for a vaccine program to prevent COVID-19. In anticipation of a successful clinical trial, Pfizer plans to activate its extensive manufacturing network and invest in an effort to be ready to produce a COVID-19 vaccine, if approved, as quickly as possible. In Westchester County, County Executive George Latimer announced a new memorial May 6th, the, quote, Ribbons of Remembrance, unquote, dedicated to Westchester County residents who have lost their lives to COVID-19. The memorial is a short walk from the Lenore Preserve parking lot in front of the Whitman Mansion and overlooks the Hudson River and the Palisades. Visitors are encouraged to write the name of someone they have lost on a provided ribbon and tie it to one of the two trees or the rope structure. New Rochelle Mayor Noam Bramson wrote in a blog post that the pandemic had disproportionately impacted low-income immigrant communities in the town's south end. Though the virus was first detected in the north end's Wiggle neighborhood, now 90% of active infections are in the town's southern two zip codes. Bramson wrote there were many reasons for this, such as more densely packed neighborhoods, language barriers, and a higher proportion of essential workers, reasons that are not unique to the town. State statistics show African Americans and Latinos are more likely to have died from COVID-19. In Orange County, the owners of Woodbury Common Premium Outlets retreated on May 6th from a plan to reopen the shopping mecca in Orange County next week, a move which would have flown in the face of the state's reopening plans. Simon Property Group announced May 5th that it has opened 59 shopping centers in 13 states that have lifted coronavirus closure orders and will open 18 more within the next week. Its schedule originally indicated that 7 malls in New York, including Woodbury Common, shops at Nanuet, and the Westchester in White Plains would open May 16th, just a day after the state's closure order is set to expire. A spokesperson for the property group said the announcement was mistakenly sent to the New York malls. In Dutchess County, during a May 6th virtual town hall, County Executive Mark Molinaro suggested counties in the Hudson Valley north of Westchester and Rockland would be treated differently in the state's reopening schedule, despite being grouped in the two downstate county with the two downstate counties. 7 counties in the Hudson Valley are considered part of the Mid-Hudson region for purposes of reopening the state. Each region will have to meet a series of goals to reopen, and Westchester and Rockland, which have felt far heavier impacts from the virus, would almost certainly drag down the numbers for the entire region. Molinaro said that Governor Cuomo had publicly and privately acknowledged the differences between the two parts of the region. Quote, I will tell you quite confidently that privately they've acknowledged that Rockland and Westchester are different from the rest of the region, so we are confident we will be given a certain appreciation for that difference, unquote, Molinaro said. Quote, but also be aware that our proximity to New York City poses for us areas of concern, unquote. Molinaro also cited a falling number of hospitalizations as proof that the county had turned a curve. Quote, we've begun a new day, unquote, he said. The number of people hospitalized from COVID-19 peaked at 110 on April 9th, while Molinaro said 64 people were hospitalized as of May 6th. 58 residents have died from the coronavirus. This is 18 more than was reported by the county on Sunday, and the county's COVID-19 dashboard still shows 40 deaths. But the dashboard notes the county, quote, has received a large amount of new data from various sources that is currently being verified, unquote. It is not known if this new data includes the revised nursing home fatality numbers released by the state on May 3rd. Putnam County. The county's annual 4-H fair will not take place this year, the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Putnam County's Board of Directors announced May 5th. Quote, the Putnam County 4-H Fair showcases the best of our communities, unquote, County Executive Mary Ellen Odell said. Quote, every summer the fair brings families together for good food, lively music, and fun times, while youngsters get a chance to display their leadership skills. We will certainly miss it this year, but I know that when the 4-H Fair returns next year, it will be the best one yet, unquote. In Sullivan County, Monticello Central School Board President Lori Aristano James will join Legislature Vice Chair Mike Brooks, County Manager Josh Podosek, and Public Health Director Nancy McGraw for a virtual town hall May 7th at 1 p.m. Questions can be submitted on the county's website. In Ulster County, Project Resilience, an Ulster County initiative that has tapped over 150 restaurants to produce meals in bulk for residents that have been impacted by COVID-19, will halt restaurant deliveries on May 16th. but the program will continue in an altered capacity in its second phase. Quote, it's just a shift to groceries as opposed to restaurant meals, unquote, said Assistant Deputy County Executive Dan Torres on May 5th. Quote, additionally, we are helping some residents get services they now qualify for. We have already done 20,000 meals worth of groceries on top of the 100,000 hot meals, unquote. Kingston Police and State Police in Ulster County said they have not issued any tickets for failing to comply with the mandates of New York State on pause. Kingston Police have issued 6 verbal warnings, 5 for failing to socially distance or for holding a gathering, and 1 for not wearing a face mask. A community septic project in Shedanken has been temporarily stalled by the pandemic, the Walton Reporter reports, as the contractor has pulled employees off the site due to health concerns. In Columbia County, the county's health department announced 45 new confirmed cases May 6th, Columbia's county's largest one-day gain. 43 of those cases come from the Grand at Barnwell Nursing Home, where the State Department of Health is testing all residents and staff. Over half the residents at the nursing home, 112 people, have tested positive for the virus. In Delaware County, Public Health Director Mandy Walsh and Programs Manager Heather Warner have been working 7 days per week coordinating Delaware County's COVID-19 response. The two women were profiled May 6th in The Reporter, where they spoke of the challenges of responding to the pandemic. The pandemic hasn't stopped the Catskill Watershed Corporation's funding for economic development, municipal wastewater, septic system, and other projects in the New York City watershed, although the Catskill Watershed Corporation Assistant Executive Director Jason Merwin anticipates, quote, some potential tightening of funds somewhere down the road, unquote, he told the Walton Reporter. The Catskill Watershed Corporation is funded by New York City to support a variety of watershed protection and economic development projects in the city's large upstate watershed, where a complex layer of regulations governs land use, building septic requirements for homes and businesses, and more. The Delaware County Board of Supervisors will hold a virtual meeting Wednesday, May 13th at 1 p.m. via Zoom. The public is welcome to attend the meeting online. In Greene County, the Athens Street Festival, which was scheduled for July, was canceled on May 4th due to the coronavirus. It joins several large annual events that have been canceled in recent days, including the Gray Fox Bluegrass Music Festival, the Trailblazer Festival, formerly the Taste of Country, and the East Durham Irish Festival. 27 more cases of COVID-19 have been diagnosed at the Pines at Catskill Center for Nursing and Rehabilitation, according to a letter sent to families that was acquired by the Register Star. The infected residents have been grouped in a separate area of the facility, and the nursing home is awaiting test results for several more residents. In Schoharie County, a labor union representing county workers filed a grievance against the County Board of Supervisors for temporarily laying off 95 employees, saying that they did not receive the 30-day notice required in their contract. County officials said that what the union was calling layoffs were actually furloughs. The workers will continue on their health care and accrue vacation days, and said they were surprised at the grievance, pointing out that most of the workers would be receiving more money under expanded unemployment benefits. The move was an attempt by the county to fill an anticipated $4.2 million budget gap. The Joshua Project, a nonprofit based in Middleburg, got a logistical assist for its backpack project, which aims to provide a week's worth of food to some 400 Schoharie County schoolchildren and their families. The Mountain Eagle and Schoharie News reports that plumbing and heating parts distributor F.W. Webb Company will provide a truck and driver to transport the food. Universal Plastics, which has a plant in Howell's Cave, has switched much of its production to making face shields. The company is making about 1,000 shields per day at its plant in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and using Howell's Cave as a distribution point. The Schoharie County Department of Health is reporting 2 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 on May 6th. In an April 29th post on Facebook, County Health Director Amy Gildemeister expressed worry that the number of cases each week in the rural county was on the rise. This has been the coronavirus report for Thursday, May 7th, from theotherhudsonvalley.com and therivernewsroom.com. Go there for more information about anything you heard here.
Hello! Today is Thursday, the first Thursday of the month, actually, which means the cluster bomb of a phone call we call the Singularity Radio Program airs tonight on WGXE at 7 p.m. Okay, enough shameless promotion and on to the numbers. Low 40s this morning, better than the 30s we have been seeing. Blue skies help push that temperature up to 63 degrees by 3 p.m. This afternoon, near dark, light rain is expected. Tomorrow morning, a low of 41 might give some people false hope that spring is on a roll. The day has a high in the mid-50s around 3 p.m. After that, rain enters the area again and temperatures begin to slide. Make sure that tomorrow you bring in or cover your plants. Also, bringing in firewood early in the day is a good idea. Saturday morning will be below freezing and snow is expected. Pollen levels will be medium today, high on Friday and low on Saturday. The next high tides will be at 3:36 p.m. and tomorrow at 3:59 a.m. The next low tides will be at 9:59 a.m. and at 10:12 p.m. Water temperature will be 55 degrees today. Sunset today will be at 7:41 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:42 a.m. Looking way up, we see surprise brightening and outgassing of Comet Swan. Some astronomers speculate it may be breaking up, but others point out that it may not necessarily be the case. And we will be keeping an eye on it. 5 near-Earth objects are expected today, the largest of which will be 282 meters wide. Solar wind speed is currently 321 kilometers per second at 5.8 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 1, quiet. There have been 5 days since the last sunspot, and this has been the Better Weather brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Jeff Moore of Copic, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Congress, in its wisdom, has prohibited pirate operators, that is, people who operate without licenses, from ever owning a low-power station. On the other hand, that same pirate could own, for example, WCBS-TV in New York City.
Somebody shake me, break me, when it's over. This is Randall Martin along with Alan Scarrett and Kim Singletary with the Afternoon Show.
Today, hello, everybody.
Good afternoon.
We trust that you're all doing well. Let's get right into it, because today we have an international show. So, and a lot to talk about. So, Kim, why don't you give us an update with how you're feeling and what's going on?
Well, there, like you said, there's a lot of stuff going on, and you know, a lot of talk going around in our communities, our families, among our friends, and a lot of stuff going on. I mean, I don't know how you all feel about the headlines that saying that the percentage of Black people that are succumbing to COVID is triple that of other communities. What do you think about that? How you feeling about that?
What's the fear? It's number one, it's a fact. Number two, there are reasons for the facts. So there are obvious reasons why, if any such malady should affect a community or our communities, that the most vulnerable will do the most suffering. So what do you say beyond that? We can't stop the source of suffering. So I don't know why wasting time talking about it a lot is going to help at all. That's my opinion. So if you're asking me what my thoughts are about it, that's what my thoughts are. Of course, it's a fact. Did you hear about the Navajo situation out there in Arizona, New Mexico?
I heard about the Navajo situation. And even, I think, over in Alaska, some of the population of the indigenous people there are being adversely affected as well. But what do you mean, my brother, when you say that there's nothing we can do? What do you talk to me about that. That sounds a little bit fatalistic. You know I'm the optimist, so talk to me.
Well, I don't think talking is the key here. I really don't. I don't believe that a lot of talk is what we've had ever since we came up with that factor. I haven't heard any Black leaders, except maybe that come on Democracy Now, you know, some college professor or some stage person will come on there with Amy Goodman and make mention of this situation. But I don't see where anybody else is doing, white or Black, is talking too much about it in terms of, you know, the obvious nature of this kind of thing. It's like smallpox with Native Americans. It's the same thing. So, I mean, I don't know. What do you think of the talking part? Yeah, we're talking about it. That's all we're doing.
Okay, well, I think the change starts with, you know, conversation and communication. And then I think that, you know, our community, as other communities that find themselves being adversely affected, need to have some responsibility and some accountability as well. So, yeah, I agree that if we just talk about it, ain't nothing going to change. But not having had the conversation at all, didn't even have it on people's radars. You know, there are some of us who have been talking about it for a while, but now it's getting more into the mainstream attention that there is something that is going on. And Randall, why don't you jump in here before I go with it? Because I'll take it.
I'm listening and waiting for a good moment. You know, I think that this just underscores the underlying issue of the disparity in healthcare. I don't think that, you know, this what has come out with this disease is that, you know, people that have access to health care are just generally in better health for the most part. And people that have more or limited access to affordable health care don't really tend to go to the doctors, don't really tend to really get in to treat those underlying conditions, which has made this disease more fatal to communities of color. But then there's also an aspect of the kinds of work that many communities do. And I think that there's a large service sector and hospital sector, and a lot of human, a lot of the work is being done, and a lot of the casualties are done with people that have large amounts of human contact. And so I think that we have to talk about it, but we also have to make a commitment to figure out how we can make and maintain the health of our communities by building up immune systems, by eating properly, and that foundational wellness will then translate into better health when diseases and viruses come. Because if your immune system is weak, whether you're old or young or rich or poor, you know, you're going to be adversely affected. So, you know, you have to be strong, you have to be healthy, and that has to be a community priority.
So do you think that this is an opportunity? You know, one of my, and this is a digress to for a minute, but I was reading a headline, an article today that for the first time, universal student loan forgiveness is on the table, right? It's something that some people have been, you know, presenting for a while. Now it's getting widespread attention, and it looks like it's a now or maybe never time. So do you think this is a now or never time for universal health care? Because that's what I think is one of the things that we can do with educating people, especially the people who have been resistant to universal health care, to have the conversation of why this experience makes the case that we try universal health care. Well, no. Is that one of the things, Alan, you think we can do?
No.
Why not?
No, because we are not the United States of America. We are this North American continent that is divided into red states and blue states. The red states are not going to comply with any blue state agenda. What they call people who propose universal health care are socialists and communists. That is the rhetoric. They spin it all through the red state community, and they are certainly totally oppositional with their dumbass to do anything to comply with a recommendation or a review of what the benefits are from having a universal health care system. They are satisfied with paying insurance companies three or four times more money than they even have to pay them for the sake of being, you know, on the side of a racist, fascist society. So what the hell are you going to go with that? Again, we can talk about universal health care all we want. We can talk about it, fine. It ain't going to happen unless it's a civil war, which there is now.
Okay, so we're on opposite sides of what's possible. They thought the slave wasn't going to be liberated, okay? I'm saying they thought we'd never see a black president in the White House. So, you know, I'm saying that I'm going to hold on to the idea that we can make transformation and we can make change. But I do think it's kind of like a now or never time, because if people can't understand how not having universal health care is tanking our country and our national security, and you know, we have to, I mean, I read something that said, and I don't know if it's true, I didn't do any due diligence on it, but I read or heard someone, a pundit, saying that 90% of our pharmaceuticals, you know, are manufactured in China. You know, I mean, it's just a matter of national security to have, you know, pharmacies, and, you know, we're buying ventilators from Russia and China. Come on, you know. So I think if we make the case that it is a matter of our own national security, that we, you know, and we have to have, I think, a universal health care program in order to cover the cost of medical supplies, even. But
yeah, Kim, I mean, but when you say we, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about people.
Okay.
I'm just talking about people, period. There were people. You know, I know it took a civil war to end slavery, But, you know, I'm talking about people, the same people who have pushed the agenda, you know, uphill, true, you know, but who have pushed agendas for liberation and more justice and more equity all along. I'm talking about people. And I'm talking about people who are versed in the conversation, who can take the conversation out into the people. And if we're just having, you know, we do this around the table talk kind of a thing, because these are the conversations people are having at home around the table or on their cell phones, right, or whatever. But, that's, you know, right, if we can take these conversations like we're doing today and we can take them into a wider audience, you know, there'll be more people who will see, you know, maybe even be on the fence about the issue, who will now come over and help make the change. But I heard you trying to jump in there, Randall, so I regress.
I see you guys are going fast and furious, and that's and that's good, because this is a vigorous debate. You know, I agree with Alan in the sense that, you know, some of this is race driven in terms of where healthcare resources are allocated and who gets what and who gets treated for what. But I also think that this, as you say, this is a time when people can really see that the question used to be, can we afford to have universal health care? And I think this is clearly demonstrated. The answer to the question is that we can't afford to not have it. In this era of these superbugs and diseases and viruses, it's necessary for a nation, as a national policy, to have healthcare enshrined in people's rights. And I think that we need to get to that level quickly. And it is actually a matter of economics and not a matter of race. And maybe we can get past that. And I think there's a lot of young people that are recognizing that we have to be and live in a fair and equitable world, which, as all the other leading nations have figured out, starts with being able to have your citizens be healthy and productive. So I don't think it's going to take a war to do that, but it is going to take some lobbying and a consciousness to say that we can't just go back to the same old way that it was before, that was broken and has been seen that it's broken. We need to have a new approach. And, you know, Obamacare was actually a step in that direction. I think that you're probably going to have some sort of tiered health plan. But even on the basic level, we need to start a program where we're talking about wellness, not sick care, but keeping people well. And that starts with regular visits and regular nipping, you know, regular interactions with your doctor that kind of nip these diseases in the bud before that they spread and become these humongous catastrophic problems that have surgical intervention and all sorts of fancy machines to diagnose. We need to be in the business of keeping people well.
A new program is bringing nurses on furlough from upstate hospitals to New York City to help out at understaffed hospitals in the epicenter of the COVID pandemic. While nursing staff at many New York City hospitals have been pushed to the breaking point, hospitals upstate are cutting staff. In response, the New York State Nurses Association has launched the Upstate COVID Nurse Corps to deploy nurses to hospitals that need additional staff. According to Sean Petty, a nurse at Jacoby Hospital in the Bronx, they are most desperately needed in the smaller community hospitals that treat some of the city's most vulnerable populations.
It would be a huge help to those nurses, to those hospitals, and more importantly, those communities, because ultimately, who suffers are the communities, are the patients being cared for there.
So far, more than 120 nurses have volunteered for the Upstate COVID Nurse Corps. The first nurses were deployed this week to a hospital on Staten Island. Petty says hundreds of nurses have been placed on unpaid furlough by upstate hospitals, and redeploying them where they are needed just makes sense. But some hospital administrators aren't cooperating.
We're facing resistance from some of these upstate hospital systems, in particular Albany Medical Center, but also a few other ones who are not releasing some of these nurses to come downstate.
He adds that participating nurses are being paid by the hospitals where they are deployed, and the state is picking up the costs of housing and transportation. And while New York City is at the peak of its COVID surge, Petty notes that the pandemic isn't expected to peak in many upstate communities until late May or June, when they will need experienced nurses to handle a growing patient load.
They'll be in situations where the newest treatments are being implemented. They'll learn all of the modalities of care, and they'll be able to lead entire teams of nurses as they go back into their communities.
He says coordinating the deployment of nursing staff to meet shifting medical needs is a win for both the nurses, the hospitals, and the communities they serve. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
There's no indication that foreign actors are slowing down their efforts to try and interfere in the 2020 election cycle.
David Levine with the Bipartisan Alliance for Securing Democracy is concerned about states' abilities to safely and securely conduct elections this year.
Russia, for example, engaged in some disinformation efforts around the Iowa caucuses. We know that the Department of Homeland Security, as well as a number of other federal and intelligence agencies, put out a statement at the end of last year indicating that Russia, China, Iran, and others will try and interfere in the 2020 election cycle. And there's been no indication, even in light of COVID-19, that there's been any change.
Election security is a priority for America's intelligence community, and it's the Director of National Intelligence, or the DNI's, job to oversee the 17 spy agencies tasked with preventing foreign interference. The Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee expects to vote next week on whether to advance President Trump's nominee for the director job, Texas Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe. Ratcliffe served on Trump's impeachment defense team. His name was put forward for DNI before, but withdrawn after bipartisan criticism of his qualifications. At the Senate's first hearing with social distancing, Senator Mark Warner, top Democrat on the committee, expressed continued doubts.
I don't see what has changed since last summer when the president decided not to proceed with your nomination over concerns about your inexperience, partisanship, and past statements that seem to embellish your record.
The former director, Joseph McGuire, was reportedly pressured to retire in February after an expert on his staff briefed Congress that Russia was meddling in favor of Trump in 2020. McGuire's one of the half dozen intelligence leaders who've been ousted or resigned under duress in the last year. At the hearing, Ratcliffe walked a fine line, asserting his independence, admitting Russia did try to interfere in the 2016 election, a charge Trump resists, but that the interference didn't change the outcome.
The intelligence I will provide, if confirmed, will not be impacted or altered as a result of outside influence.
All the lawsuits and other changes due to COVID-19 have only expanded the need for election protection, according to Levine from the Alliance for Securing Democracy.
You had postal delays, right? You had concerns about voters being able to choose between their health, right, and being able to cast a ballot. And those kinds of situations are opportunities that can be exploited by foreign adversaries to undermine confidence in the integrity of our election process.
In other news, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, recovering from a benign gallbladder condition, joined the other justices from a Baltimore hospital to hear arguments on the White House effort to allow employers to cut out contraception in healthcare coverage for religious or moral objections. And Biden scored two major endorsements, former Attorney General Eric Holder and leading LGBTQ group Human Rights Campaign. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Welcome to Lifting Voices. I'm your host, Renee Powell, president of the Troy, New York branch of the NAACP. And with me today is Noreen McKee, who is a board member of the Rensselaer County League of Women Voters and a member of the Troy branch of the NAACP. So in this interview, Noreen and I will talk about the amended changes to the executive order and also focus in on the voter registration process. Noreen, welcome to Lifting Voices.
Thank you, Renee. It's great to be back.
And we're going to begin with talking about the change to the executive order. So how did the change to the executive order affect what we talked about in our interview?
The executive order allows the Board of Elections to send out applications, the application form that we discussed in our last meeting. You first have to get an application form to vote absentee and then fill that out, send that back to the board, and then the board will send you the ballot. Now, the change is that the boards can automatically decide to send application forms. So the difference is in the past, before the order, you had to initial the request for the application form. So that's a change. Now, we don't know yet if the Board of Elections, what they have decided to do in Rensselaer County. They have not made that decision yet. So as we get closer hopefully soon they'll make that decision. But it's not mandatory. It does allow them to do that.
Now, in the last interview, you often made reference to the Board of Elections needing to verify that you are a registered voter. And this applies to any voting option. You have to be verified whether or not you're a registered voter. So in this interview, we're going to back up a step and talk about becoming or being a registered voter. So my first question to you is, did the governor's 2020 executive order have an effect on registering to vote? And by that, I mean, were there any deadlines extended? Is there anything that's different from what was permitted last time?
Not in terms of registration. The only change really is because of the date, the governor canceled or combined the presidential primary, which would have been held on April 28th, with the state primary, state and local primary on June 23rd. And to vote in any election, you have to be registered. The registration, you have to be registered for the June 23rd election by May 29th. And that means your registration, if you register by mail, it has to be postmarked by the 29th. And if you register in person, you have to do so on the 29th. That's the last day.
Okay, so everything is by the 29th. Now, my next question is, how are people to register with the social distancing? Can they do this online? Do they have to do it in person? How is that going to happen during this time?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can do it in person. I actually called the Board of Elections this morning to see, if they were open and how it worked with the coronavirus. And they said that they are open. You can enter the building at 1600 7th Avenue. It's the Pattison Government Center. And you would enter on the third floor entrance, which is really the main entrance to where the legislature meets, the county legislature. And you'll just let the security guard know that you're there to register, and he'll call down and they will bring up a registration form for you. You can fill it out there and give it to them, and they'll check it and make sure that everything's in order. And then you'll get a card about, I don't know, it's up to 6 weeks later, stating that, you are a registered voter, but you can always call and make sure that you are registered.
Oh, great.
You can also, that's in person, but you can also, if you have a computer and a printer, you can download a registration form online from the Board of Elections, and that's www.rensco.com/back departments. And then under departments, you'll see a list on the left side of the screen, and you'll go into the Board of Elections, and right there, you'll be able to download a registration form, fill it out, and then on the back of the form, it has the addresses of the building, of all the county boards of elections in New York State. And you would just put it in an envelope and mail it back to them.
Okay, so it would still have to be a document mailed in. It's not an automatic online registration.
No.
So now we know about how to register. The question is, who can register? And one of the things that has come up when I've worked with groups to register voters is we've come across people who've been in trouble with the law. Right. And so who can actually register to vote?
Right. Okay. Well, the requirements are, the basic requirements are, you must be a U.S. citizen. You must be at least 18 years old on the date of the election. And you have to be a resident of your county for at least 25 days prior to the election. And then the fourth requirement, if you cannot be in prison or on parole following the conviction for a felony. Though if you have been released from prison and are on parole, you are automatically eligible for consideration for a voting restitution pardon, and you can apply to the governor to restore your right to vote.
And those who have misdemeanors, they can vote. That's an issue.
They're eligible.
Now, when it's time to vote and you're registered and you go to the polls, is there anything you need to take with you or have with you when you go to vote?
No, you don't need ID. You do not need an ID. You just enter your polling place and you tell the poll worker who you are and where you live, and it automatically come up when
I have received in the mail a nice yellow card that tells me where I can vote. And it's been brought to my attention that there's a new voting site.
It's a second council district. It's Johnston Supply. They're at 2600 6th Avenue in Troy. And that's in the second district. And that's the voting districts that will use that polling place are the 9th and the 10th voting district. Now that's an election day only polling site. There's also a new early voting polling site, the first one in Troy, and that is located at the Holy Cross Arminian Church up on Spring Avenue. And so that will be an early voting site along with the Skodak Town Hall and the Brunswick office building.
Okay, fantastic. Noreen, that's a good bit of information you provided us with in making sure that we have what we need to be counted in this upcoming voting process. Is there anything else you would like to add that we did not cover?
I just wanted to be sure that, I gave you the Board of Elections website, but the League of Women Voters also has a lot of information, and you can also download registration forms mm-hmm. from them. And
that website, again, is www.rensco.gov.
Com. That's for the Rensselaer County Board of Elections. Yes.
Okay. And then the League of Women Voters website is vote411.org.
Well, that's not their website, but okay. you can access that through their website, or you can just, if you just want to go to vote411.org, you can enter that information. But to get to the League of Women Voters website for New York State, just put in your browser New York State or NYS League of Women Voters, and it automatically bring up the state league's website. And on that website, you can download the registration form, and you can access Vote 411 as well.
Oh, that's awesome. So if you go to that website, you could handle a lot of things without going and searching for different websites.
Yeah, and you can, if you have a phone, to keep up with some of the, all these voting changes that are going on, you can text VOTE, capital VOTENY in caps, text that, and then put in 474747, and then you'll get updates from the League of Women Voters on all the changes related to the COVID, all the COVID changes related to the election.
Noreen, I want to thank you for coming back to Lifting Voices and explaining to everyone one of the many ways that our listeners can lift their voices.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I look forward to more conversations with you, Noreen.
Okay, Renee. Thank you.
Hey everyone, this is Peter Sergey, the arts correspondent for Hudson Mohawk Radio Station. What you're listening to right now is Sam Torres' new single.
This is Kendall Mead of Mascot, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra.
Hay acciones cotidianas para ayudar a prevenir la propagación de enfermedades respiratorias. Lávese las manos. Evite el contacto cercano con las personas enfermas. Evite tocarse los ojos, la nariz y la boca. Quédese en casa cuando esté enfermo. Cúbrase al toser o estornudar. Limpie y desinfecte de manera frecuente los objetos que toca. Para obtener más información, visite cdc.gov/COVID-19. Este mensaje es gentileza de la National Association of Broadcasters y de esta estación.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Kurt Wayman of Theater Consultants Collaborative. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for May the 7th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. A decision on the fate of 700,000 so-called dreamers.